Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, they are everywhere in the sea, making up a staggering 90% of the biomass in the ocean. They drive the carbon cycle. They even form clouds. They feed the biggest animal that's ever existed on Earth, and yet we know comparatively little about them. I'm talking, of course, about plankton. Vincent Dumazil is a senior advisor on the oceans to the United Nations Global Compact and author of The Power of Plankton: How Plankton Made Life on Earth Possible and Why It's Key to Our Future. He joins me now. Vincent, welcome to the program. In researching this piece, I found out so many fascinating things. And the first off, is it right to say that plankton is not really a biological type of microorganism? It's defined completely differently.
Yeah, plankton gathers a wide range of creatures and organisms which are all characterized by the fact that they live in suspension and cannot swim against the current. They are drifters or wanderers. And the word plankton comes from the word planktos in Greek, which means drifting. That's what they are. So they gather a very wide range of organisms, once again, which goes from tiny, tiny virus, which can be 50,000 times thinner than a hair, up to the siphonophores, which is the longest animal on the planet, which is a kind of a jellyfish, which could be up to 100 meters long.
What?
So that's comparing plankton, the smallest plankton to the largest plankton, is like to compare a hand to the size of Great Britain, actually. And to be noted that plankton, the word plankton is the same as the word planet. I mean, the roots of the word plankton comes from the same roots as the word of planet. And plankton are drifting in the ocean, just like the planet, our planet, is drifting in the universe. You know, so that's a bit like this very small comes to the very large and the very big, but they are all the same.
I did not know that. I thought plankton were just always microorganisms. And when I think of plankton, I think of these wildly exotic and varied different types of microorganisms that don't really look like anything else. Those sort of zooplankton that I'm thinking of, they are very important to how our entire planet functions.
Yeah, I mean, all plankton are very important to the way the planet is working, actually, which is why we are doing all of this and trying to raise awareness about the role of plankton, which we start to know about it. I mean, we start to understand, because once again, it's invisible mostly, even though the jellyfish are not invisible, of course, but most of the plankton is invisible, so we don't know anything about it because it's in the ocean and invisible. That's two reasons for us to ignore it, looks like. But it's so important. And some of the creatures are very, they have different forms and they are beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
Some of them are amazing. The most famous one being, the copepod that you may refer to, which is like a very, very small crustacean. And they are essential to create food for the entire food chain in the ocean and beyond. They are also essential to oxygen the ocean. To move the oxygen in the ocean, because they are the biggest migration on Earth. They sink in the deep ocean at night and they come to the surface at during the day to hunt. So they contribute to a good mix, healthy mix in the ocean. But any plankton is vital, and more importantly, they are vital to the biggest part of the planet, because they are vital to climate, they are vital to the cycle of water, they are vital to oxygen creation, to nutrients and phosphate circulation, and so forth. So all the geochemical process rely on plankton, actually.
You have said that plankton defines the temperature of the planet. How can that be?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, we know that the ocean absorbs 30% of our emission, and most of it is due to plankton. Because depending on the type of plankton you have in the ocean, they will sink in the ocean, or they will stay at the surface. I mean, typically, to make it very, very simple, the ecosystems for the last 300 million years are characterized by some type of plankton that have a shell. Which has, by the way, created the rocks we know. And the Dover's Cliff, for instance, they are all shells of dead plankton, actually, just like the sharks we use at school and so forth. But we're not going to that, not now. But when the dead plankton have shells, they are sinking in the deep ocean. So they are sequestering carbon doing that massively, because there are a lot of them. They represent, as you say, 90% of the biomass in the ocean. So they sink a lot of carbon when they sink. But if they are replaced by plankton that stays at the surface, as it is the case right now because of our human activities, so they tend to be replaced for the last years by plankton that stays on the surface, then the carbon will be released in the atmosphere and will not be sunk in the deep ocean. And that's a big, big difference, because then we are talking about 30% of the global emissions that are currently absorbed by the ocean that may not be anymore. Maybe the ocean will start to emit carbon as such, and then that will be the end of the game for all of the existing ecosystem, because none of us can survive this. I mean, and you can become vegan and take your bike and do whatever you want. I mean, that no one will reverse the magnitude of that change. So that's why it's so important to keep the plankton communities as they are, because if they change, the rest of the ecosystem will change and we will disappear.
So what has changed that has allowed the plankton to stay on the surface? Why is the plankton staying on the surface and not sinking now?
Because this type of plankton, they have no shells. They do
not
create
any shells. Why have they suddenly flourished?
Well, the different type of plankton domination, you know, because of all the anthropic activities, like releasing nutrients, releasing phosphate, warming up the climate.
Right, and so the dominant species at the surface is they've thrived in this new environment as opposed to
exactly.
The... Right, okay. Because I was going to ask you know, when we look at plankton, you know, it's so diverse. They can't be very well genetically related, right? I mean, it's got to be a lot of diverse plankton out there. Why do we see that? Why don't we see a sort of a monoculture of plankton, given the free reign of the ocean and the resources that you need to take advantage of to survive? Why don't we see a monoculture of plankton?
Because we don't know anything about plankton, but really, we don't know anything. Just to give you an example, 10 years ago, we launched an expedition to characterize virus in the ocean, to understand the virus, and we knew about 40 different virus in the ocean at this time. 10 years after, we know 500,000. So, and that's the same with any genes and any type of plankton that is in the ocean. We have discovered 150 million new genes in the ocean over the last 10 years. I mean, we are in our body, we have 20,000 genes. So you can imagine what 150 million new genes are. And we have discovered only 10% of what's in the ocean. So we cannot cultivate plankton. We don't know how to do that because we don't know them. We don't know what kills them. We don't know what makes them thrive. We don't know what supports this community or these others. And that has consequences on all the food chains. I mean, today, there's the whales, and we are so concerned about the whales, and no one cares about what feeds them, but we are so concerned about the whales, but the whales are starving more than anything. I mean, overfishing is not the biggest of their concern. Their biggest concern is starving. I mean, they don't have food anymore. So we need to understand that, and we need to learn how to cultivate plankton in the future, indeed, so we can, I mean, create the balance in our ecosystem. If we understand plankton, then we will understand the entire biology of our planet, and we'll be able to repair and heal the planet, which makes sense, because if you think about it, I mean, over the last 4 billion years of life on Earth, life has started 4 billion years ago. 3.5 billion years are purely plankton in the ocean. And then life goes in the continent and so forth over the last 500 million years only. It's like an epiphenomenon. So the basis of everything and 90% of the history of life on Earth is in the ocean, and it's plankton. So if you want to repair something, I mean, you don't start with the roof, you start with the foundation. And the foundation of life is plankton. So let's look at it. If we want to create the right balance and the right equilibrium for our planet, and repair our planet and reconnect the cycle together so it works again.
What's the main function of phytoplankton? What do they do differently than other plankton?
Well, first of all, we decided that's an interesting thing as well. we decided that, I mean, in plankton, you will find fungi, you will find bacteria, you will find archaea, you'll find virus, and something that we call phyto and zooplankton, which is denied by science today because we tried to map what's existing on land into the ocean. But once again, life on land, 500 million years. Life in the ocean, 4 billion years. So you can imagine that the level of complexity is way, way bigger there than on land. So the frontier between vegetal and animal is not there. I mean, it's not even existing. I mean, they are all both, basically. Most of them are both vegetal and animal in the planktonic world. Hmm. So that we can call them vegimals, like transgender plankton. But it's more than this. They can either feed on other plankton, or take the light and create biomass out of sunlight. But anyway, what we called phytoplankton, which is the lowest trophic level, which is the first level of biomass creation. So they are very unique because they do photosynthesis. So they take the sunlight and the carbon dioxide, and they create their living matter and they release oxygen in the atmosphere. And that's quite unique. And doing that, when they started doing that 2 billion years ago, they destroyed everything because oxygen was a toxic gas for life at this age. So they destroyed 99% of life on the planet, releasing oxygen. After that, life evolved and learned how to use oxygen, and all our ancestors did the same. So we all come from there. But know this phytoplankton is quite unique because they will create, they are the lowest trophic level you can find in the ocean. They will create all the biomass. And they create it very, very quickly. Hmm. Like every day, the phytoplankton creation is equivalent to, like, if you take a plank of wood, you know, like a piece of wood, normal one, like 30 centimeters, it would go every day from the earth to the moon. I mean, the plankton creation. Wow. So it's like a huge creation, a huge biomass creation, more than anything, and a lot of oxygen as well.
Wow.
It's crazy because the plants are the other big source of oxygen. So basically, plankton is 50% of the oxygen creation, roughly, and the plant on land, they are 50%. But plankton is 0.2% of the biomass, while the plant are 80% of the biomass.
Wow.
So you can imagine how efficient they are at creating oxygen and the rest of the biomass.
But I imagine the introduction of the plastics and microplastics over the past number of decades has been hugely problematic. But do we have any evidence that microorganisms and plankton are badly suffering because of plastic?
Well, that really depends. First of all, remember that all the plastic we have comes from plankton. So it can be easily replaced somehow in a more compostable way and even edible way by living plankton, actually. We are working on some prototype. I mean, plastic comes from petroleum. Petroleum is this sedimented plankton that died like a billion years ago. So every year... out of our oil consumption, we consume 1 million years of sedimented plankton. So every year, we consume 1 million years of dead plankton who sedimented. So so that's oil is plankton. So we can replace that with plankton or with some of their descendants like we do with plant or seaweed. But... and actually, plastic may harm some plankton, and plastic may benefit to some others. I mean, it's always the same, and that's an interesting story about it, because we will not destroy life in the ocean. Life has been very resilient. It will be there. The question is not about whether life will stay in the ocean. The question is whether the ecosystem we are sitting on will remain. If life changes in the ocean, we will disappear because we are adapted to a very specific mix of life. And if it changes, then we will disappear. So it's the same with plastic. I mean, plastic is a problem for some of the plankton. It benefits to some others. If you take the jellyfish we were talking about, we know that we have a growing number of jellyfish in the ocean. I don't know if you heard, but some years ago we had a jellyfish like 26 kilometers of jellyfish with a thick, I mean, with 8 meters thick, who passed by a salmon farm and they destroyed everything. Yeah. Anyway, we have growing number of jellyfish in the ocean. We are going to an ocean of jellyfish because jellyfish, they are plankton. They are very, very basic animal, and they benefit from everything we are doing. So they love climate change because they are very resilient and they love warm waters. They love overfishing because overfishing kills their predator and their competitor. So they are easy. Mm. I mean, they love plastics because the plastic bags will kill the turtle, which are their predators. And a turtle can hit up to 300 jellyfish a day. And even better, jellyfish, they will spawn their eggs on microplastics. Because of their floatability, it will enable their eggs to spread around the world. And jellyfish, they can spawn up to 19,000 eggs a day. So they are very, very prolific. Wow. And they can spread them around the world because of microplastic. They will benefit from all the phosphate and nitrogen we put in the ocean because it will boost phytoplankton, so their food. They will benefit from acidification because acidification prevents plankton to create their shells, so it's easier for jellyfish to eat them, and so forth. So we know that, I mean, it's not like tomorrow will not be the planet of the apes, it will be the planet of jellyfish, maybe.
I wanted to finish up by asking you about the man who ate plankton and lived on it for 65 days, because it's mad to think that, you know, giant whales just eat plankton and can survive and feed their enormous bodies. So can you tell me a little bit about this guy?
Yeah, it's a crazy story because this guy was a doctor who was obsessed about shipwrecked and the people dying in the lifeboats. And he noticed something interesting is that people in lifeboats, they die, they theoretically, they could only die from cold after a couple of hours, from thirst after 3 days, or from hunger after 3 weeks. But actually, most of the people, and there was, at this time, it was in the 50s, we had 50,000 people dying in lifeboats after the shipwrecks. So he realized that all of them almost, they die after 1 or 2 days. And after a lot of research, he realized that they were dying out of despair and fear, mostly.
Despair and fear.
Yeah, because they thought that there was no solution and so forth. So he thought like, okay, the best solution to give them is hope. Let's give them hope. And to do that, I will prove them that we can survive in a poor rubber dinghy floating in the ocean for many days. And in order to do that, he used the rainwater. He used a bit of urine as well. He used a bit of seawater to get some drinks. But to get food, he fished a bit, of course, but not that much. But he used a plankton net. And using that plankton net into the boat, the plankton net, he left the plankton net in the ocean during all the day. And over the day, the plankton net collected plankton. And it was like a slimy sludge, not really appetizing, I should say, but full of lipids and proteins and vitamin C and all the nutrients that he needs. So, well, sort of. But at least he didn't suffer from starvation or from scurvy. And he crossed the Atlantic doing that on his own in a solo crossing, 65 days alone in the ocean, eating plankton in its plankton net. And after that,
incredible.
Thousands of people, in any lifeboat, you had a plankton net after that. And thousands of people wrote him to tell him that, yeah, they survived because they knew about his story. He did a big book, which was a big success worldwide. The Voluntary Castaway is the name of the book. And they survived because of hope and optimism. And I think, widely speaking, I mean, this message is so important.
Yeah,
we are in a world terrified. And when we are feeding the next generation with fears and drama. And I mean, it can kill them way better than the actual danger, I feel.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to feed them with hope and optimism.
Yeah.
And plankton is a source of an unlimited source of innovation, unlimited source of solutions for the world of tomorrow. And so, I mean, just like this poor guy in the ocean, let's get our plankton research. Let's get some hope and optimism, and I'm sure that will fix all the problems we have for this planet.
Vincent Demezel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.